Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, today's show is another edition of Something Old, Something New. This week, my guests are Ben Drew and Ed Skrine. Ben Drew is the platinum-selling musician Plan B, who shot to fame after his hit 2006 album Who Needs Action When You Got Words, The Defamation of Strickland Banks and Ill Manners. His friend Ed is an actor who's graced both the small and cinema screens in shows and movies such as Game of Thrones and Deadpool. Together, we're going to discuss the albums and films that have sparked an interest or nugget of inspiration between these two guys' respective careers to date. That is all coming up on Culture right here on Monocle 24. Ben and Ed, welcome to the programme. Nice to have you here. It's bright,
you're fresh. You're good at that, Rob.
Yeah.
He's got very
we've covered it.
You've definitely got the voice, and the introduction was perfect.
Silky smooth.
It's sometimes it's smashing nicey time here on Monocle 24. Don't knock it. We're going to kick things off, as we always do, with how people met. Sometimes people have been brothers and sisters or people that work together, people in the same group, all the rest of it. Ed and Ben, tell us the first time you met. Was it mates at first sight? How did it kick off?
It was carnage and destruction. It was, Ed was DJing at Camden Palais, which is now called Coco.
Yeah.
And he was told not to play certain records. Mm. You know, he was told not to play Pharoah Monch.
Well, they told Simon me to just says, play Will Smith, I quote, and Keith Sweat.
Right. Okay.
And I said,
no,
yeah,
DMX.
Of course, no problem. But my whole record collection was Onyx, DMX, Tupac, and Wu-Tang.
So I was up on the balcony. I think I'd already performed because it was like my first live performance. And it was a daytime rave. And, you know, there was quite a lot of, I don't know, hoodlums in the crowd.
Street kids, because it was an under 18 rave in North London.
Oh, wow, okay. Yeah. An under 18. Daytime rave, under 18s at the Camden Palace.
So you just imagine all that young energy thrown around. Everyone's in gangs. Everyone's rolling around in gangs. So much bravado, testosterone.
Well, like, I remember one geezer just caught my eye. He had an Averex leather biker's jacket on with nothing on underneath.
Okay.
And he had a bandana around his neck like a cowboy. And I remember he caught my eye. And I was watching him in the crowd, right? Because Ed started playing DMX or Pharoah Monch, Simon Says, or one of them. And everything started getting super rowdy, like straight away, instantly. And they start moshing, and an altercation instantly breaks out between him and a rival gang, and he pulls out some CS gas.
Wow.
Sprays it.
In the middle of the dance floor.
In the middle of the dance floor. The minute people realise what's going on, everybody, you know, people start screaming and dispersing from the dance floor, and there's just this one girl left in the middle just screaming. Then I look over at the stage and I just see one of the organisers run over to it and just
literally
pull
rip
the track.
The record off.
Yeah,
of this.
Pull the track.
They turn the lights
like
on, everything.
And then when they done that, when the music stopped and the lights come on, there's just this one girl in the middle of the dance floor all on her own, just holding her eyes, screaming. It was distressing, to say the least.
So basically, so you were watching from the balcony Ed destroying the reputation of a fine North London music venue, and you thought, this is my kind of guy. Ben, your first choice, we're going back to 1997, is The Prodigy's Fat of the Land. Before we talk about that, let us refresh our memories of that fine LP. Make my bitch up. That is a cut from The Fat of the Land by The Prodigy from 1997. When did you first remember hearing that record, Ben?
Oh, I mean, I remember when I first heard Prodigy, it was... And my mum worked all the time, my stepdad worked all the time. He was a head chef, so he worked, like, ungodly hours, so he was never there. And then my mum used to roll home around 8 o'clock. So we had a German au pair live with us. And she'd look after us, you know, in that time in between when we got back from school. And she was into metal and grunge and, you know, alternative kind of music. And the only music I'd heard up until that point was stuff on, you know, Capital Radio.
Yeah.
Really was not versed in anything that you would deem as kind of cool, you know, or left of field. And then I came in her room and she had... Music for the Jilted Generation album. Yeah. And I remember just being drawn to the artwork. I was like, whoa, what's this?
That's that head in profile with it kind of being stretched both ways, right?
Yeah. And she said, oh, it's the Prodigy. Have you not heard it? I said, no. So she puts it on and it completely blew my mind. And I remember at the time, I think jungle music was just coming to prominence, you know, like from the underground scene, and just started kind of spilling over with mixtapes like Jungle Mania and stuff. I remember there was a time when I was kind of getting into both of those things, and I just remember that someone trying to explain to me, for example, what jungle music was, with me never hearing it, and someone saying, like, it's kind of like rap, but it's a lot faster.
Yeah,
it was a similar kind of experience to kind of learning about jungle music and also learning about Prodigy, and suddenly my world just kind of opened up musically. And I think actually with my own music, the reason why I'm able to be alternative when I want and cross genres but still have a pop sensibility is because I was brought up on pop music and then discovered all this other stuff, you know. So my own stuff obviously is influenced by both, you know. But with Prodigy, I just loved the artwork and I loved Poison especially. And it was that time when I think we'd just got cable TV, and remember that channel, The Box?
Yeah.
And Poison used to come on all the time.
Yeah.
And No Good Start the Dance. And I just got, you know, fully into Prodigy and completely addicted to it. And then so when Fat of the Land's come out, you know, I remember that, you know, Prodigy was a group.
Because this
was
a big album. This was not an underground sort of hit.
Well, this was the
underground
crossover.
Going overground, right?
This was the crossover. This was the one where I went to school, and friends of mine, I think at that point, everyone had, it wasn't fashionable to listen to jungle anymore, and everyone was listening to garage. But friends in my school that you wouldn't really associate Prodigy with were coming into school and singing Firestarter.
Yeah, people that loved rock music, people that loved Britpop and stuff. This was the same age that Be Here Now came out. You know, I mean, that kind of big puffed up Oasis record. People that were buying that were also buying this. There was a lot of crossover of all sorts of stuff there. What about the culture that went with it? Because these were banned on XL recordings. This was Richard Russell stuff, but this was also, as you said, you'd only ever listened to Capital FM before. This was stuff that was also on Capital FM with some of the language obviously taken out for those.
Well, I think the whole culture of it would have completely passed me by because of how young I was.
Yeah.
You know, I never got to experience the rave culture. It was always something that really intrigued me, but I was way too young to kind of get involved in. So it was purely about the music for me.
I mean, we were 14 when it came out, so you know, you think about all that young energy floating about, and you know, at that time, I know I'd only really. The only music that I'd really got into was like Jamiroquai and things like that.
Yeah.
And then I remember seeing it and seeing Keith with his nutty hair and then.
Oh, the videos are amazing.
Probably terrifying. Yeah,
yeah, terrifying. But actually, to us, it was like, oh, this is great. This just speaks to me. And you know, it's submersiveness. I suppose that blend between the underground and the commercial is something that we've always been chasing since, and we're still chasing. And you know. Other people can judge whether we've ever achieved it, but yeah, that is the aim. What they did there was really something special.
Yeah,
it's one of those things. You can do it. You proved this, Ben, with those things. You can have that edge. You can have the reality of talking about where you came from and of the club culture that you got into, or the you know, this is garage and jungle and these kind of things, and taking it mainstream. It can be done.
I mean,
right?
Ill Manners proved that.
Yeah.
Ill Manners was a straight UK hip-hop record, you know, uncompromising. And the reason I made it like that is because it was a soundtrack to a film. It was never that I was making an album that needed to succeed commercially. I was making an album that needed to fit the mood and atmosphere of a film. And therefore, I didn't compromise on the music at all. Obviously, with the title track, Ill Manners, you know, I realised that was something that was really addictive sounding, and that your man, Peter Fox, he had a hit with it in Germany. And obviously, I'd been touring and promoting the Strickland Banks record, you know, all over Europe.
Yeah.
So I'd come across the track over in Germany, and I thought, wow, this is a great track. I have no idea what he's saying, but this is something that I could do in the UK. I could use that instrumental. It's actually when people ask me what song I'm most proud of, I'm really proud of how I kind of spun that on its head and kind of done it in my own way. And I managed to say exactly what I wanted to say within that 3.5 minutes, you know, and do it in a way that, you know, that I was, you know, really proud of. And that in itself, you know, was the only part of that album that I kind of knew if it's going to cross over, it's going to be that song. And what I didn't expect was for the album to go number one and to have the success it had. He's got some front, ABU, be the joker, play the fool, politics,
ain't it all, smoke and mirrors, April Fools, all year round, all in all. You've picked Matthew Kassovitz's La Haine, fantastic French film. Tell us what this film means to you, some of the scenes in it, maybe the reality in which it's set. Where's that coming from?
I mean, following on from the Prodigy theme, you know, this is subversive arts, this is underground culture, this is street level culture, this is people that are on the peripheral of society, the people that have been outcasted, this is about the lower classes, people who aren't traditionally given a sophisticated artistic platform to have their voices heard, and this movie was so sophisticated. I just think it's just such a well done piece of art. You know, the camera work is incredible, the acting from Saïd Hubert and Vince is just so beautiful and so natural, and you know, that film had such an influence on us, and especially had a big influence on Ill Manners, which was my first ever acting job, Ben's first directing job, and it had a huge influence on us, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, the cinematography is beautiful in that film.
Yeah,
we didn't have that kind of time or budget, but I think films like La Haine, Pusher, by Nicholas Winding Refn, Shane Meadows, the approach that we had was based on budget and stuff. But to make it visceral, you just have to point the camera real people, you know, which I don't think, you have to correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know how much of La Haine was improv.
Yeah, do I don't know. It feels like not all of it was exactly workshop, right, or written down.
Yeah,
it feels like there's a lot of reactions having a camera put in your face.
But I think in terms of the topic and the world that we was
occupying,
yeah, definitely it was like Ill Manners was the British equivalent. I don't know, can we say that?
We were trying to do that. That's certainly what we were trying to do.
I think that's what we was aiming for.
I think there's a couple of differences. One difference is that we made the principal photography shoot of Ill Manners, we had 150 grand to make it. Theirs was also low budget, but I think they had €2.5 million. Now, so that means they can use steady cams.
And they shot on film.
They shot on film. They could have, you know, you could see some of them were sets. There's an amazing scene in it, which is Vincent Cassell doing the taxi driver thing in the mirror. Now, I found out when I was geeking out over it that scene was shot, that when the camera comes round and it goes through the mirror, and you're thinking, how can we not see the camera's reflection? There's no mirror. It's just there was an actor. The back of his head is another actor. And they've done all this amazing stuff. So I'm not sure how improvised, actually, that was, because the camera moves are so specific. I think that that they would have had much less grounds to improvise than something like Pusher, which, as you say, has that shadowy, frenetic energy, and then Ill Manners as well was.
I don't think you can see the influence of La Haine in Ill Manners. I think it's more of, after watching that film, it changed us, changed me, and it definitely made me feel empowered, you know, and want to do a similar thing, in the sense that if they're talking about, you know, what it's like for that class of people living in the suburbs of Paris, then I felt empowered to want to tell the world the story of what it's like for, you know, the equivalent of that class of people living in, you know, East London.
I think that's so important, mate. I think that this notion of empowerment through art is relevant in all of our choices. probably all the rest of, and the next two as well. It's a very important thing.
Okay, well let's move it on, because I like that. I like that theme of actually just picking up on the vibe of something, or picking up on the energy of something. It can be something that's outside of your zone of interest, even, or mm-hmm. something that's very unlike the story that you might want to tell. But something about the energy of something, right? The language of something, the way something leans.
Definitely.
Is something that yeah. you can definitely pick up on. Ben, let's come back to you. You've picked Skinny Man, Council, A State of Mind. The table turners are right on you now. Say goodnight as I'm putting your lights out. Should have taken me out when you had the chance. Under the moonlight, time to meet the devil and dance. Ask Nas, you from the hood, you have to get yourself a gun. And when it's on you, don't pop your shit and run. You stand firm till the old clip's done. Or else you'll have a slim chance of seeing tomorrow's sun. Okay, as chosen by Ben there, is Councillor State of Mind. It's Skinny Man. So you're releasing your next LP in April, Ben. It's called Heaven Before All Hell Breaks Loose. How much do you get into the vibe by listening to other records, and how much do you have to kind of ration yourself off so you don't pick up too many tricks?
Like what we said about the films, really, you get off on the vibe of something. I mean, just listening to that track now, just it's always done something to me, you know?
It's a great track. It's nice to hear you, but sadly, off mic, both singing along to that.
Yeah.
That's a bit of value for listeners always. That they will never yeah. receive.
Always. Yeah. I think there's some records in my life that I've just never walked away from. And actually, they've raised the bar for me so much that it's made it very difficult for me to get into anything new. And, you know, back in those times, I had more time on my hands. You know, my house was the place where we'd congregate. And, you know, that was a period of my life where I was just smoking weed and listening to records. And then what that was then preceded by me getting into hip-hop, meeting Ed. I was a singer and a garage MC.
Mm.
And Ed was a DJ and a rapper. And... you know, Ed told me I needed to slow my tempo down because I was always trying to be too lyrical. You know, when I was MCing to Garage, it was way too conscious. And
is that when you've got a lot to say though? How do you put that into a box?
It was more that Garage was supposed to be party lyrics and be quite simple.
Mm.
And I was sitting there, you know, at a party trying to get conscious with people and trying to fit in too many words into a sentence. And Ed was just like, look, you might just slow it down and do hip-hop, you know. And it was at that time, because actually it went from being, you know, my house in Forest Gate with all my friends coming around my house to congregate, it became me going up to Chalk Farm to it was a music...
community studio, I
yeah,
suppose.
Yeah, music
it.
Community studio that I went to. And I going up there, and obviously I met Ed, you know, at the show. And then after that, you started working with that same studio.
Exactly,
and then we just
yeah.
started seeing more of each other. Then it ended up being me congregating at Ed's, which was the Triangle Estate off Goswell Road.
Yeah, and this album will always remind me of the Triangle and the nights we'd spend yeah. up there. And it was a shithole. You know, I moved in there, I think, when I was 17, and it was just like ashtrays with mountains of butts in them, and there was red stripe cans everywhere. And but we used to, it was golden times for us in terms of independence and creativity, and they were very formative in those times. And this album just sums up that period for me, you know.
I love the fact that both of you, and we talked about the Prodigy, we talked about Latin, we're talking about Skinny Man. I won't spoil the next choice, but it's very much to do with what you're working on next, Ed. They're all, we've talked a bit about the music and about, but it's all about how it makes you feel. It takes you back to a certain time.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose that's the point of these things, right? Although the minute you drop the needle on the record, something happens to you that isn't talking about music.
The thing is, Skinny Man was being very honest. I mean, he's always been very honest, but, you know, he's living that life. I remember that I listened to that record and I was like, this guy is amazing. And I couldn't believe that it wasn't more successful than it was. But that's indicative of UK hip hop at the time. I mean, it was so, so independent. You know, a lot of them guys, you know, they just wanted to put records out. They didn't necessarily know how to sell it. They weren't kind of businessmen in that sense.
And a bit of anti-business to do with that kind of thing as well?
Yeah,
a
but also...
A bit of having your credentials of... of being kind of homemade and DIY was kind of part
of the success. I saw a skinny man getting pulled over by the police on his bike in the N1 shopping centre in Angel.
Right.
I was like, oh, skinny man. Yeah. And he's just, police was just swarming around him, and he was on his push bike, you know, and I know that, you know, post that album that he'd been in and out of jail, I don't know how many times, but I know that life really hadn't changed much for him after that, you know. The guy is as real as it gets, and he's talking about an environment, and when you hear him talking about that environment, and he's talking about it in quite a pessimistic way, like it's not going to change, you know. And I remember that there's a lyric that always stays with me where he says, no one in this British rap game is making it. As in, the Americans don't care who we are, and they ain't got time to listen to our music. So none of us are going to break it out of here. None of us are going to cross over. And it's always kind of stayed with me, because obviously...
Sounds like you heard it as a challenge though, Ben. Right?
Yeah, of course. But the thing is, I'm taking the challenge on, and it is difficult. I mean, they think we're Australian.
Yeah. Every time I'm over there, they're like, oh, where are you from, mate? Yeah. Australia. I'm like, London, mate.
And like, they don't want to hear, you know, Australian rappers.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Basically.
But do you know what?
And it's a shame, because the stuff that he's talking about in that album is just so on point. Yeah. And
it's emotionally universal. Yes, it's specific to North London, but it's emotionally universal, the things that he's talking about. And it's certainly hip-hop universal. And the production level is such that it's good enough to stand next to any album from any country. And when we were touching earlier on this notion of empowerment through these records, now Skinny Man empowered us as young teenage hip-hoppers, rappers, whatever. He made it seem real that we could do this. You know, I was from North London, so I'd see Skinny Man going up and down Holloway Road all the time. You know, he's like a mentor to us, and it made it seem possible that Skinny Man could make a record like this meant we could make records like this. Yeah. And therefore we could make art that is as sophisticated as our American peers, you know, but we can do it through us.
With Skinny Man, there was no commercial success there to look up to or aspire to be. It was about the art. We was hearing a piece of art and going, I don't care if, you know, I'm of a minority of people that know about this. This is good.
Yes.
This is brilliant. And if I'm going to do this, this is what I have to aspire to artistically. Got nothing to do with commercial success.
We've got time for your last choice, Ed. We're still in the same chain of events. We're talking about the sort of underground going overground. It's Barry Jenkins' hit Oscar-winning movie. It's Moonlight. We're going to have a clip first.
Give me a hit. Hey, let your head rest in my hand. Relax. I got you, I promise. I'm not gonna let you go. Hey, man, I got you. There you go. 10 seconds. That right there? You're in the middle of the world, man. That's good.
A clip from Moonlight, Barry Jenkins' film, that really kind of united quite a lot of people in its with its Oscar-winning ways. What was your immediate reaction to seeing this film, Ed?
I mean, it changed something in me in the same way that all the great art that I've seen over the years has changed something in me. I remember I was in Austin, Texas, shooting a movie with Robert Rodriguez, James Cameron, and all, you know, it was a big, huge VFX movie, but Robert's got the instincts of the underground and keeps it intimate and keeps it small, so it still felt like a small thing. And Mahershala Ali was working on that movie, and I met him, and they said, and I was speaking to him about it. You know, one of the producers was saying, oh, Mahershala's in this next movie, it's gonna be huge. So Mahershala was telling me about it. I said, you know, I'm gonna go see it tomorrow. I'm gonna go, I got the day off. And I went with two other members of the cast, and I was just blown away. I'll never forget where I was sitting in that cinema, three seats from the back on the, you know, from the left in the back row, and just what an effect it had on me. You know, there's so much about this movie, I could talk about it so long, but like the cinematography is just beautiful. You know, it's gorgeous, the anamorphic lenses, the blurring that you get from it, the 360 shots, the one shots that they do are just so beautiful. The acting is so subtle, the subject matter is so important, that we have, yes, a coming of age story, and yes, we're giving voice to, you know, young kids, inner city kids, you know, from the ghettos in Miami and whatnot. But this is a story about a young man struggling with his homosexuality in the black community. You know, it's so important. You know, we talk about voices and the voices that we hear, but all of the voices, most of the voices that we hear are just white, European or North American voices. We don't hear these stories, and it's so important we hear these stories for people all around the world that want to, that are going through these things. And then as a storyteller, you know, I felt like they left so much out. They cut all the fat out of it. There was no exposition, you know. They never explained what happened to Juan, to Blue, to Mahershala's character. Really, there was a couple of little bits, and they just stayed in the character, stayed with the emotional narrative of Chiron. And
I thought it was a film like a short story, right? There are very few films that have the guts to allow you to fill in the blanks.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. As a reader, as a viewer, did you know you might work for Barry Jenkins when you watched this movie?
No, it's crazy because this.
Should say that if Beale Street Could Talk is Barry Jenkins' next movie. Are you shooting that right now?
No, I shot that at the beginning of the month in New York.
Yeah,
and that was just like, you know, to be able to work with someone who had such an impact on my, it was like doing a song with Skinny Man in 1999 or you know, something like that. It meant so much to me. And the time scale is very interesting because I only heard about the movie from Mahershala exactly 1 year ago. It was the end of it was near Halloween actually, last year. Saw the movie, loved the movie, and that movie actually really helped me finish off writing a short film, which I've just finished directing on the weekend. Now, when I was doing that, after I'd worked with Barry, I said to him, I hope you know that I'm going to just copy you completely for this short film. And same with the DOP. When Moonlight was in the cinema, I said, right, I'm going to take the whole cast and I want you all to come and watch this movie, because this is how you act. This is how you tell stories. And this is, you know, the benchmark for how it's done. So I took this cast of like eight kids, teenagers, early 20s, and we went to the Hackney Picture House. And I forgot something. I forgot how generational certain things are. Now I'm 34, I'm a dad of two. I don't even think about the homosexuality in it. Really, it's just a love story. Now, as soon as any of the homosexual stuff was going on in it, you could just see them going, covering their face. Oh,
the kids.
And when we came out afterwards, all they could talk about was, but would you do that though? Would you take that role though? Tell the truth. Like, if you was offered that, would you take that? And I was taken aback by it. And, you know, I think there's something interesting as well in the choices that we've done of Lahaine and Moonlight, because Lahaine is so specific to the energy that me and Ben had at that time, that rowdy energy of fuck the world and fuck everyone, and you know, that underground subversive nature. And then Moonlight is this beautiful, sophisticated, elegant, wonderful story that kind of, I wonder if we'd have seen it when we were 17, what kind of reaction we would have had to it, you know what I mean?
The thing is, we're talking about voices for the voiceless, you know, there's no more voiceless people. If you think that coming from poverty generally makes you quite voiceless, well, coming from poverty and being gay in such a homophobic environment such as the streets are, they're even more voiceless, those people. And yet it does come down to being immature at that age and allowing peer pressure to affect the way you react to homosexuality. Also, being young and you know, just popular culture and also kind of underground music, you know, is steeped in a lot of homophobia. And to even admit at that age that you watched that film and you enjoyed it means that you're going to be attacked by, you know, the community around you, you know. So it's like, the older we get, we forget about that stuff.
Yeah. There's a lot of face and keeping of and saving of face, isn't there?
But it's great that, you know, we were once kids just like the ones that you brought to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And then now in our 30s, you know, that stuff just doesn't matter anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's it makes me feel very optimistic about the future for these young people that, you know, the rest of society kind of really writes off, because we were those young kids and we've managed to kind of come out of that environment as, you know, positive, free-thinking adults, to the point where, you know, we can sit there and appreciate a film like Moonlight. Mm. And, you know, I went to a Q&A screening in South Bank of Moonlight with the writer Terrell and Barry, you know, and got to hear kind of firsthand, you know, about Terrell's, you know, experiences and what, you know, it inspired the film. And I remember one of the things Barry said was that, you know, he was in two minds about whether he should make this film. And the main thing was about the homosexuality part of it. And he just said, look, if I can't make a film about this and there's something fundamentally fucked up about me, and look what came of it. You know, we're sitting here talking about it now.
About Oscar-winning Barry Jenkins, you know what I mean? And also, I heard him say about the movie, you know, that in one of his interviews, he was like, yeah, I'm not gay, but these stories should not be only left up to gay people to tell. It's like, and men can tell women's stories, women can tell men's stories. This, you know, this is not, you know, this is a human problem. If it's a human problem or issue, rather, then it's up to humans to tell that story. You know what I mean? So so all of these lines and divisions, you know, they shouldn't be there in art. And, you know, what he did with it was just so beautiful.
Well, listen, thank you both very much for drawing this line, taking on this journey from The Prodigy to Let Ain to Skinny Man to Barry Jenkins and Moonlight and your next film as well. Ben, Drew, thank you very much indeed. And Ed Skrine, Plan B's new album, Heaven Before All Hell Breaks Loose, is out next April. You can download the new single, Heartbeat. It's out now. You can see Ed Skrine on screen in several films next year, including that Barry Jenkins directed If Beale Street Could Talk. This show was produced by Holly Fisher, and we'll be back at the same time next week. For the time being, I've been Robert Pound, and thank you very much for tuning in.
I'm just listening to my heartbeat, to the tune. From the start.